Welcome to episode 53 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm John Hickner, family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. We're recording on July 1st, so tomorrow is my parents' 65th wedding anniversary, so happy anniversary, Mom and Dad. And we're recording just before July 4th, and we hope that all of you have a safe and joyous holiday festivity.
Thanks, Henry. And you make your parents listen to this podcast? That's not very nice. Oh, boy. Okay, on this podcast, we highlight POEMS, which stands for Patient-Oriented Evidence That Matters. If you want to get all of the POEMS, over about 250 a year, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus, where you get a POEM daily, a great primary care reference, over 800 chapters, and thousands of interactive decision support tools. Go to EssentialEvidencePlus.com and check it out. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast does not represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. This week we discuss a couple of COVID papers, treating UTI with telehealth, migraine prophylaxis for kids, and variation in lab values. So first, and very briefly, there were a couple of recently published studies, one in JAMA and one, I think, in Lancet, that asked the question of what is the seroprevalence in the wild, in the community for COVID-19, and how many undocumented cases are there per documented case? I think those are things we're all wondering about. One was in the Swiss canton, think county, state, around Geneva in Switzerland, one in six U.S. states, and was done by the CDC. They used different methods. They were different countries, but they actually got roughly the same answers on prevalence. It ranged from about 2% to 8% in the U.S., or 2% to 6% in the U.S., about 4% to 10% in Switzerland. So overlapping ranges there. So I think we can broadly say probably 2 to 10%. And it's going to vary. It was highest in New York City. It was lowest, I believe, in St. Louis. They also reported about 10 undocumented cases per documented case, which is, I think, a useful stat to keep in mind. And they both, again, somewhat different sampling strategies, but 10 undocumented per documented case. Next one. First of all, any comments on that, John?
The challenge is clear for control. I mean, we've talked about this already, but when you have roughly 90% of cases, either very mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic, how are you going to control it except with social distancing measures? And our country doesn't seem willing to do that right now. I hope we change our mind.
Henry?
Yeah, so this really does reflect that this really is a clandestine bug, and that we've really talked ad nauseum about some of the non-pharmacologic interventions that we are doing while we're hoping that a vaccine will become available. In a recent issue of Lancet, just I think it was last week, a tiny study from China, just over 100 patients tested with three doses of a recombinant RNA vaccine that demonstrated some antibody response with mild symptoms, but that means we're still, quite a ways away from a large 20,000 plus randomized trial to get a vaccine that's truly effective. And, the big concern here is, are we going to rush to get any old vaccine, or are we going to try to get something that will meet the FDA's recommendation for at least 50% effectiveness?
Yeah. And how long will those phase three trials take to get enough patients? Yeah. Hopefully they'll be thinking about, as they're seeing hotspots emerge in the U.S., targeting those communities, because they're just going to continue to emerge. I mean, it's just going to, I think, just be a continuing one long wave, perhaps compounded in the fall by influenza in the winter. But please encourage your patients to get their flu shots, make an extra special effort to do that. Yeah, it's going to be a long fall and winter. Actually was just, got my first haircut in 4 months. So went to a new barber and recommended by my good friend, Jay Seawick, who used to edit the American Family Physician Journal for many years. And coincidentally, completely out of the blue, has a home half a mile away from me up here in Northern Michigan. And Jay recommended the barber. Everyone, masks required, plexiglass, shields. It was, pretty good for Northern Michigan. Okay, next one is our first POEM, and this is self-diagnosis of uncomplicated UTIs. And it was from Journal of General Internal Medicine, 2020, volume 35, page 643. So many of us are doing telemedicine, telehealth kind of visits. So this study describes over 20,000 telemedicine encounters over 2 years by patients who were seeking care through an internet-based, standalone, national direct-to-consumer telemedicine service. So a for-profit telemedicine service. 84% of those in the study had self-diagnosed a UTI before calling, and the rest were later diagnosed with a UTI. 96% of the calls were from women, mostly younger women, about half between 19 and 39. Only 1% were over age 65 years. 92% of the time, the clinician agreed with the self-diagnosed UTI, and 94% of the time, those women were given an antibiotic. Of the 6% who were designated as high risk because they were men, they were over age 65, or they were diagnosed as having pyelo, 69%, so almost 70%, were given an antibiotic via telemedicine. Almost 1 in 5 patients with pyelo were treated with an antibiotic by telemedicine rather than being referred for an in-person visit or obtaining urine culture. Physicians giving an antibiotic were more likely to be given a 5-star rating than those who didn't, 96 versus 85%, which is a bit disheartening. Most patients reported that they would have attended an urgent care clinic if telemedicine hadn't been available. It wasn't investigated in the current study, but other studies have found low risk of complications with telemedicine management. So, bottom line, large study of women using a telemedicine service for self-diagnosed UTI. They almost always got an antibiotic. And there may be some overreach. Nearly 70% of high-risk patients, those men over 65 or with pyelo, were given an antibiotic without being seen in person. Henry?
Yeah, this is like deja vu all over again. It reminds me that more than 25 years ago, the three of us were in our master's program, and one of our class assignments was to do a cost-effectiveness analysis or a decision analysis. And we were given permission to collaborate, and we did this really sophisticated cost-utility analysis. It ended up getting published in the Journal of Family Practice and in the publication that led to us doing a whole bunch of scholarly presentations, workshops on cost-effectiveness analysis. And in the conduct of some of our presentations, we got these questions from real-world clinicians who said, but wait a minute, we manage a lot of these women over the telephone, which was not part of our strategy. So that led to us doing the very first randomized control trial in history of the telephone management of any condition. And what we've seen over the years is very consistent data that women who call and say, I think I have a urinary tract infection, about 2/3 of the time, they've got it right. And so, you know, it's when you start thinking about decision analysis and at what point do you start to treat, for many conditions, that 2/3 exceeds the diagnostic threshold where we would often go ahead and treat. So it's not a surprise that over 90% of the women who thought they had a UTI got an antibiotic, because chances are they really did have one, and that's appropriate management.
John, any other comments?
Henry, isn't that the reason that your wife dubbed us the three wise men?
Yes.
And we each have the porcelain figurine to prove it. Yeah, that was a long time ago. That was good. We really enjoyed that time at University of Michigan. he says to the MSU guys, getting our master's degree. But good discussion. And certainly, I think it's perfectly appropriate management. Like you guys, I think would agree to manage many of these patients that way and give them an antibiotic. I think the important thing is having adequate follow-up. So, you know, you have a way to check in with them or clearly explain what the expected course is going to be. And if it's not matching that, and certainly if someone has pyelo-like symptoms, if you do treat it with an antibiotic over the phone or over telemedicine, you got to have some kind of follow-up and a clear plan for, you know, 2 days from now. If you're not a lot better, you know, you need to go into the urgent care or go see your doctor. Henry, it's time for a quiz.
Yeah, so this is a little bit of a nerdy quiz, if you will. So when you hear the three of us discuss recent research, we're often not terribly explicit about the two different types of validity that we assess. One type is called internal validity, and the other is external validity. Internal validity basically asks, do we trust this research? Did they do a good job at minimizing biases that would allow us to believe what they with their conclusions? So did they do a good job? And through our filtering process and choosing poems, rarely will you ever hear us talk about fatally flawed studies unless there's something comical or a really important learning point about them. The other type of external validity really asks, how do we apply this research to caring for our patients? So the question, the quiz is, which of the following statements about externally valid research are true? A, study participants are homogeneously selected. B, study participants come from research labs at academic medical centers. C, the study reports rates of outcomes, both beneficial and harmful. D, the intervention is innovative and cutting edge. Stay tuned.
Love the cutting edge. Okay. So, and we get to hear more from Henry because it's time for his poem about migraine chemo prophylaxis in kids.
Yeah. So this study asked the question, which medications are effective in preventing migraine in children and adolescents? This was published by Locker and colleagues in JAMA Pediatrics just this past April. These authors searched a whole slew of databases, a clinical trials registry, and they were looking for randomized trials of medications used to prevent migraine in children and adolescents less than 18. They used a variety of outcomes in the individual studies, so the authors had to kind of create their own little hierarchy of outcome measures and then pick the one that was reported by the individual studies, the one that had the highest level on the hierarchy. So, for example, the highest one was the monthly rate of migraines, and the lowest one was the headache intensity, frequency, and duration. So they combined all of this stuff. They did a network meta-analysis to try to compare directly and indirectly the effects of each of the individual agents. So they found 23 relatively short duration, less than 3 months, randomized trials with 2,200 children and adolescents with migraines. So that works out to be less than about 100 per study, less than 50 people per study got active treatment. The quality of the studies was kind of mediocre. And the agents, the classes of agents that they looked at were anticonvulsants, beta blockers, antidepressants, calcium channel blockers, and a variety of supplements. And what they found was that most of the agents that they looked at had a tendency towards benefit, but very wide confidence intervals that included the potential that these were ineffective. And when they did the network meta-analysis, what they found was that propranolol and topiramate were the most effective, but again, the confidence intervals were quite wide. So here's the good news. We've got reasonable evidence that multiple agents are probably useful for preventing migraines. The bad news is that many of the medicines that we might use have only been studied in single trials, which means more work is needed, which is good news for researchers because that means academic job security.
We all need job security. And, you know, I think the title didn't quite match. I'm maybe a little bit, you know, have more of an optimistic bias, and at least we have a couple of things we can legitimately try, realizing that to some extent there may be a placebo effect, which we know is more common in painful conditions. And if it's a safe drug, like I think propranolol, certainly, you know, we can feel okay thinking it could work, or it could just be a good placebo and the patient's benefit. So, you know, I took away a little more of a glass half full from this. The network meta-analyses are interesting. We're in the process of doing one on antibiotics for community-acquired pneumonia, and man, it's complicated. They're not just like, you know, it's really challenging modeling, and to do it well, I'm still trying to learn how to do it. I'm going to end up enlisting a biostatistician to kind of walk us through it, but it's not a totally straightforward methodology. And, you know, so I think it has to be taken with a bit of a grain of salt. John, any comments about migraine in kids?
I'm a bit skeptical about topiramate, I have to say. There was a study about 2 years ago that we included in a poem that was a fairly large randomized trial that included topiramate and imipramine for treatment of migraines in children, and neither of them worked in that trial. So there must be some trial that shows some effectiveness, but I don't think I would use topiramate. Propranolol, fine, that's relatively harmless, but topiramate I think I would steer away from.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it brings up the sort of larger question of when do you believe a meta-analysis, or in particular a network meta-analysis, which I always look at a little bit askance, and when do you believe a large, single, well-designed randomized trial? Mm-hmm. You have to judge the external validity. You know, you have to, are they putting good and bad studies together in the meta-analysis? It can be challenging, and that's kind of an interesting question. And this is one where I might, you know, lean more on the single, well-designed individual trial than a bunch of studies, you know, thrown together that may be quite different on an individual level. Okay, thank you, John. And it's time for your poem now on lab results.
Yes, this particular poem is not a study. It's really a commentary, an analytic commentary, but it's very good, written by a great author. The clinical question that they asked was, how much variation is there in clinical laboratory values, and how should we account for it, basically, in clinical practice? Now, the reference is important because there's a special calculator that you can look up. The reference is McCormick, McCormack, and Holmes, Holmes, published in BMJ in 2020. That's enough information for you to find the article, but I would definitely look it up. Here's the synopsis. Here's a summary. Just how precise are test results? Every assay has inherent analytical variation, ranging from less than 2% for bone density test, which is pretty consistent, up to 20% for a single ALK-FOS measurement. But the larger contributor to variation laboratory tests is biological variation. That's the fluctuation in individuals, within individuals, over time due to normal physiologic changes. These two challenges to precision can make a single iron, bilirubin, or triglyceride level be inaccurate by as much as 50%. And of course, there are other challenges to accuracy, such as hemolysis of the specimen or using the incorrect tube. As an example of variation in a very commonly performed test, a single A1C test result of 6.3 could actually be as low as 5.5% or as high as 7.1%, the authors tell us. So the repeat A1C changes, if it changes from 6.3 to 6.0, it may be due to test variation rather than a true improvement. As I mentioned earlier, the authors have created a calculator for us that graphs out the effects of these variations for many different laboratory tests. The website site demonstrates the reference change value, which is the difference that must be seen between two results for the change to be considered a real change and not due just to assay variability. So this reminds us once again that you have to be very circumspect in interpreting laboratory values, and I think many of us don't pay enough attention to that. So I would urge you to find the article, to use the calculator on a few tests to see what kind of variation you really need to see before you can tell that it's really a true change in the value for that particular patient.
Thank you, John. Great comments. And, you know, certainly I remember one time it happened to me that I was getting pre-op labs. I'm not normally someone who thinks there's particularly indicated for a lot of people, but my surgeon wanted them, so I had to get them. And they got a CMP, and it found my bilirubin was sky high, my creatinine was sky high, like 5 or 6. And you know, I got the results, and they're urgently, you must be so sick. You've got to come to the ERA. We say, no, I'm not yellow, and I'm peeing. So I think there's a lab problem. And I rode my bicycle back to the lab just before they closed, and they drew another lab, and sure enough, the next day, was everything totally fine. So
Henry? They got the wrong patient's results.
I think so.
Yeah. But anyway,
what it sounds like.
Yeah. Fortunately, I knew enough medicine. To say no, that's not a problem.
You know, it's not bad enough that the diagnostic process is complicated enough to begin with, because we start off with the challenge of, you know, right from the get-go, and we often do this implicitly, what do we think is the likelihood that this patient actually has the condition? Then we get the testing, and we assume that the test result from the lab is accurate, because we know that the FDA sets these really narrow tolerances in order for them to approve the assays, and we know that our certified labs go through, you know, fairly rigorous processes of testing and calibration and monitoring in order for them to maintain their certification. So we trust that, and we forget that biological variability, the collection techniques, was the tourniquet on too long that resulted in the calcium levels being off? Did it sit out too long so that it hemolyzed? Was the tube that was used, if it was the correct tube, how old was it? And what's the stuff that they put in the tubes that
EDTA, something like that?
Yeah,
the preservative.
Was the preservative expired in altering the results of this? So there are all these other complications, and the biological variability is probably the one that we struggle with the most. And for people who aren't really cognizant or have really not thought about it, just a really simple thing to do is measure your heart rate. Take it for about 30 seconds. Do it again under a variety of circumstances, and that will help to illustrate the point. So this really just adds to the complexity and why, for many of us, we take these implicit and intuitive processes and we sort of wink at ourselves and think we got it right.
You know, a lot of decision making, decision support often uses algorithms and flowcharts. And, you know, I'm one of the editors for American Family Physician. We often have those in our articles. It's kind of funny, you know, doctors hate cookbook medicine, but boy, do they love those algorithms. And I understand why. I enjoy making them. But you always have to be thoughtful, because with an algorithm like that, a flowchart, if you're using a lab value to send people down one path versus another, you better be pretty sure that lab value is correct. Whereas, you know, a softer, more nuanced judgment may be preferable. So, you know, I think that's always a caution when you're applying these kind of algorithms to clinical care. So thank you for sending that one to us, John. I agree, it's a great one. And I think it's time now for the quiz answer.
Yeah, so the quiz asked the question, which of the following statements about externally valid research are true? A, study participants are homogeneously selected. B, study participants come from research labs at academic medical centers. C, the study reports rates of outcomes both beneficial and harmful. D, the intervention is innovative and cutting edge. So many factors go into deciding the applicability of research findings, and this is often a judgment call based on where you practice and the kinds of patients that you see. For most primary care clinicians, we see a very diverse set of patients, and so studies that include males only or females only, with a few obvious exceptions, are unlikely to apply to most of our patients. We also find it easier to apply studies that take place in settings that look like our practices and that use office staff as opposed to specially trained research staff. So if you practice in an underserved setting, other things like cost and availability is a major consideration. When I practiced in Appalachia, access and feasibility were major considerations. I sometimes had to send a patient into the city, into the hospital, which was 25 miles away as the crow flies. And if you lived in West Virginia, you know that the roads don't go where the crows flew. So there was a very high rate of, quote, non-adherence, meaning the patients really had no transportation. They couldn't get down to get the testing done. Now, many innovations are, in fact, cutting edge and are considered experimental, and so they're often not covered by insurance until they've been proven repeatedly. So You know, we also like to look at studies that evaluate clinically important outcomes like quality of life and death of over things like changes in lab values, you know, these differences between pose and dose. And then finally, we also like it when studies present us with the frequency of both the benefits and the harms. We know that most of the interventions that we consider have trade-offs, and we need to be able to provide our patients with data on the likelihood and the severity of each. So clearly, there are many other considerations that are suitable for discussion during that awkward time between, you know, the wedding is over and you're waiting for the reception to start. But, you know, this quiz, we can just say that the right answer is C. We want to see the benefits and the harms described. Guys, what other factors do you think are important in deciding when to apply research that appears to be internally valid?
John?
I would want to emphasize the factor of whether or not the patients are similar to my patients. To me, that's always been the largest threat to external generalizability and whether or not I can apply those research findings to my patients. So that's always the first thing I look at.
Yeah. On the other hand, I want to throw a caveat out there in that I think sometimes we tend to use that as an excuse for ignoring research that may be uncomfortable or that may go against what we believe and say, well, those patients were in, you know, rural upper northern Michigan. My patients are in Detroit and this just doesn't apply. Well, you know, you got to think about, are they really that different or not? And so I would just throw that caution out there, I guess.
Good point.
Yeah. So John, we're going to close with a recommendation.
The Overstory is the book I chose to recommend. This book, The Overstory, was written by Richard Powers and was published in 2018. It was awarded the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. It is a riveting novel about the intimate interaction among nine individuals with each other, but also with trees and forests. The award-winning author Ann Patchett commented about this book, "It is the best novel ever written about trees, and really just one of the best novels, period." Some critics disagree and consider this book to be a contrived plot about a bunch of tree huggers. I have to agree, though, with Ann Patchett and the Pulitzer Prize Committee. It's really a great story, so pick it up, The Overstory.
Well, at least John and I are surrounded by trees where we live, and that's been one of my projects, one of my many projects this pandemic summer is being better at identifying birds and trees since I'm going to be living with them for a while. So I'm up to about four trees so far. I just added oak.
So bad at You're it. On your way.
Maple, well, oak, birch,
just
and
be
white
careful
pine.
Of the poison ivy.
Yeah, we'll work on it. Okay, great talking to you guys. Hope everyone enjoyed today's podcast and learned something. Please tell your friends, spread the word, tell your fellow residents and partners in your practices. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.